You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
You're listening to the Stable Management Podcast, where we discuss the barn management topics that you're passionate about.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Stable Management Podcast. Our goal is to bring you a real-world look into the parts of horse farm management that you love or hate most, such as stall bedding, farm equipment, and pasture maintenance. During each bi-monthly episode, we'll be joined by an expert guest who shares their experiences with and perspectives on an important stable management topic.
Even under the best circumstances, travel is stressful for horses. We've all been there, stuck on the side of the road in the middle of nowhere. You can make the journey knowing that U.S. Rider is there for you. Get peace of mind on the road with U.S. Rider's nationwide 24/7 roadside assistance coverage for both you and your horse. Join today at usrider.org.
I'm your host, Haley Peffer, and my guest today is Dr. Sarah Freeman from the University of Nottingham. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. I'm very good to come along and have a chat.
Well, today we're talking about a topic that I think any horse owner or barn manager has dealt with, and that is colic. So could you just start by telling us what exactly we might mean when we say colic? What are we actually talking about?
Yeah, that's a good question, because people tend to think that colic is a single disease, and it's not. Colic just means that the horse has abdominal pain. So anything in their abdomen that's causing them pain will cause colic. And most of those diseases are parts of the gastrointestinal tract, so the intestines and the colons. But we can also get colic much less commonly, but from other things like bladder stones or liver disease, something like that. So it covers a really broad range of different problems.
Could you break down for us the main types of colic and how they differ from each other?
Yeah, there's lots of different ways of sort of breaking it down. And some people do it by parts of the intestine, and some people do it by different types of diseases. I think it's most useful to think about it in terms of what are the most common ones and how severe they are. And the reassuring thing is that the most common types of colic are the less severe ones, the ones where your horse is going to get better with a single treatment or some simple painkillers. And they cover the majority of them, which is the good news. There are a few challenges. The most common type of colic is something that we called idiopathic, and that means we don't actually know what caused it. So 25% of all colics, the vet will have no diagnosis and no idea what caused it. But the good news is that pretty much all of those get better. So if your horse has a problem, it has colic, the vet doesn't really know what causes it, most of those get better, and that constitutes quite a lot. So kind of knowing that the starting point is often we don't know or don't have a final diagnosis. And then the next group that is most common is things that we call spasmodic colic and also gas colics. And spasmodic colic is where we think bits of the gut go into kind of spasm and become hypermotile, and gas colic is where we think we get a buildup of gas. And I say think because both the spasmodic and the gas colics are actually quite difficult to diagnose. We don't have a test that says it's definitely got spasmodic. So we kind of think it has spasmodic based on how noisy the gut sounds are and maybe some of the management change or the gas, the same hearing some of the gas or feeling some of the gas. But again, we don't often have a definitive diagnosis. And together, your idiopathic, your spasmodic and your gas, they make up more than 50% of the colics that we see. And then we start moving on to the ones that are a little bit more serious. So the most common one where we do usually get a diagnosis is the impaction ones, which people probably heard of beforehand. And that's where you get feed blockages that is building up, becoming a bit dry, and then stopping things passing through. So again, that's probably the most common one in terms of the diagnosis we get. And then we start moving into the more serious ones, and they are the displacements where parts of the gut moves out of place and then can't get back into the right place, and that causes a problem with the flow of the food or the fluid through the guts. And then the ones that people probably are most worried about, and correctly most worried about, are the ones where pieces of the gut become what we call strangulated or twisted, and that affects the blood supply of their diet. And they are the most serious and the most critical ones, but they cause a small percentage, a really important, but a small percentage of the types of colic that we see.
I think it's really interesting that you mentioned that idiopathic colics are so common, because I'm sure that lots of other horse owners feel this way too, but I love to know exactly why things are happening with my horse so that maybe I can improve something or prevent something from happening in the future. So it makes me feel a little bit better that even sometimes veterinarians just don't know exactly why something has happened. So you've described the types of colic really well, and I think that gives our listeners a good overview. But how does the type of colic affect the urgency of the situation and how the barn manager might handle it or how a veterinarian might treat it?
Yeah, so there's a couple of things. They differ in how they present a little bit, not always, because every horse does something different. And they differ a little bit in how we approach them. So the first categories I talked about, the sort of the idiopathic, the gas colics, and the spasmodic colics, those, most of those resolve just with a simple painkiller or something to reduce the gut spasm. So they resolve very easily. When we move on to something like the impactions, they tend to occur over a longer period of time. They often aren't as urgent, but they can become quite serious if you get some quite big impactions. But the gut isn't damaged in the majority of those. So again, they can be treated with medical treatment, usually giving fluids, something to try and get the gut moving again and break down that impaction. And where we get the real urgency is the ones where the gut is twisted and dying. And that is where time just becomes so, so critical. I'm not saying it's not important for the others, because the quicker we can treat them, the less advanced the disease is and the less the horse is suffering. But there is some really clear research that the faster you get to these strangulated lesions, the better the survival is, the lower the costs, the less procedures the horse will have to go through. So those are the ones where time becomes absolutely essential.
Now, are there certain risk factors that predispose a horse to certain types of colic? I know personally my horse cribs, so I always wonder if that predisposes him to gas colic. So I'm sure some of our listeners might also wonder about their horses with either stereotypic behaviors or health problems.
Yeah, and there are, because there are lots of different types of colic, we also have lots of different risk factors, and they predispose to different diseases. So the crib biting you talked about, so yes, does increase the risk of gas colic. And then there's a couple of the more serious types of colic, so epiploic foramen entrapment and colon volvulus, those horses are a higher risk of. Fortunately, those types, they are very severe, but they are much less common. So the sort of relative risk is low, but you're right, they do have a higher risk than other horses. But the risk factors in general, they tend to kind of vary a little bit depending on which types of colic you're looking at. So there's one, for example, called lipomas, which is where the gut gets twisted around an area of fat, a lump of fat in the intestine. And the risk factors for those are older horses and ponies, and more recently horses that have had laminitis as well. But those risk factors won't be the same for other types of colic, for example, if that makes sense. We do have some risk factors that keep popping up in lots and lots of different types of colic. Quite interestingly, one of them is actually something that one of your previous speakers talked about on the microbiome, and that's management change. And that is the biggest risk factor that we see popping up over and over again with impaction colics and spasmodic colics and other types of colics. And the good news is that is the one that we can try and do something about, because you can't change how old your horse is, and you can't change what breed it is, and you actually can't change if it's crib biting. So it's actually quite useful that the biggest thing that we can influence is something that we can change and we can try and do something about.
Absolutely, yeah. And kind of on the same general topic, are any types of colic seasonal? Should we be more aware of certain types depending on what the weather's like?
Yeah, we do seem to see seasonal patterns, but a lot of the seasonal stuff is probably, again, related to the management change. So it isn't necessarily that we suddenly move from spring to summer. It's probably that we then change the horse's management around that. So weather changes and moving them from pasture to stabling or vice versa, or changes in the grass, changes in the type of forage. And all of those are happening at season. So it's quite difficult to separate out the seasonal changes versus the management changes. And the research evidence we got is very clear that the management change is a problem. And it's a little bit more on the fence, I would say, around the seasonal stuff. So I think we see seasonal changes, but I think it's just because we are changing management across the seasons.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think maybe a good example of that is my horse doesn't like to drink cold water. So during the winter, I have a really hard time getting him to drink. I'm constantly running out there with warm water for him. But it maybe doesn't really have much to do with the weather actually getting colder or the snow, but more so just that my water happens to be very cold during the winter time, and he does not like that.
Yeah, they definitely drink less when it's cold. They're also, horses are quite interesting. They're also social drinkers. So if you, a bit like us sometimes, but they like to, if one of them goes to drink, then the others will go and drink. So if you change them from being in a pasture with five other horses to stabling them on their own, they don't have that same kind of trigger, or let's go and have a drink together. So there are other things that we're changing as well. If we're changing from summer to winter, if we're changing their stabling, we're probably changing their exercise. We're changing whether their food is dry or wet. We're changing their drinking buddies. We're changing so many different things. And those are the things we want to kind of try and control and manage.
That's so interesting that you mentioned that they're social drinkers, because I completely see that with my horse. He goes out for part of the day with his friend, a little pony, and he will follow that pony to the water just about every time, and he'll drink out there perfectly fine, no issues. So I think that's so interesting. I just thought it happened to be him, but totally makes sense.
No, it does. I mean, we're looking now more at how horses interact and what makes good welfare. And when you start watching them, the ability to see other horses, they mimic behaviors. There is, even in a yard where you've got a group of horses watching each other, one person will lead, somebody will decide they're going to start eating their hay net at 2 o'clock in the morning. And then you can see others go, oh, good idea, I'm going to go and eat my hay net as well. So, even in our barn environments, they're still following those kind of herd patterns together as well.
That's so interesting. I think we could talk about herd dynamics all day long. Unfortunately, that's not our topic for today, but we may have to come back to that. So circling back to colic, how do the clinical signs that our owners and managers might see vary between what we'd consider a mild colic, one that could be managed medically, or a true surgical emergency?
So we have some kind of general guidance and we have some ideas about it. But the really important thing to emphasize is that every horse is different. And just going on the signs alone, they can be really, really helpful. I use them an awful lot, but they don't always predict what's going to be happening. You can get some really, really tough ponies that have got something really bad going on in their abdomen, and they just carry on like everything is not really too bad. And you also have some horses where things aren't too bad and they are lying around on the floor thrashing and telling you that the world is ending. So the signs are really useful, but just be aware that there are differences in individual horses. The main things we're looking for are the severity of the signs and how frequently they are occurring. So the really bad types of colic, the strangulations, they tend to be having severe, unrelenting, uncontrollable pain. If you see those things, they are, a major, major red flag. But we also have to be aware that there's some ponies or some horses where something bad has happened and they are just then sort of internalizing that pain a little bit. So I'm just as worried about the horse that is standing really quietly in the corner. It's sweating, breathing fast, not looking at me, not interacting. So we also need to be worried about those. So we can look at the flank watching and the pawing and the rolling, and all of those things are really, really important to recognize as colic. But the horse that won't eat, the horse that hasn't passed droppings, and the horse is just quiet and depressed and doesn't want to do anything, they're also signs of colic, and they're also things that we kind of shouldn't underestimate as well.
Yeah, that's so true. My horse, a few months ago, I noticed he's very friendly, very goofy, typical gelding, and he just didn't want to interact with me, which was very odd for him. And it turns out he just was having some pain that day, and within like 24 hours of treatment, he was much better. But just those little things that we might know about our personal horses, I think, really tip us off to what might be going on inside.
Yeah, and those little changes are really, really important, because if you can pick them up, you're picking up the disease much, much earlier. You know, I've seen a number of horses with surgical lesions, and, you know, the owners have said it's come on really suddenly. And I said, you know, have you noticed anything? And say, well, actually, you know, they've not been quite right for the few days beforehand. And you think, oh, I wish we had a way of catching them in those few days beforehand, before we had the big crisis. And that is where knowing your horse really well, knowing what their routine is, and knowing whether they eat the food up normally, whether they're normally stood at the front of the stable where there is for greeting people, knowing those and looking for those subtle changes in behaviour, particularly when you're looking after a group of horses, really, really important. They can help flag problems early, which just changes a lot in terms of what can be done and how well and quickly that horse is going to recover as well.
So we've talked a lot about identifying colic and the different types, but could you tell us how veterinarians might diagnose these different types of colic once they have their hands on the horse?
Yeah, so as I sort of mentioned right at the beginning, it's often quite hard, that we have the problem that we've got lots of different diseases. We have the problem that the horse can't tell us. And we also have the problem that we can't put our hands on their belly and feel what's going on, because of the way that the abdomen is made. So in us, if you have appendicitis, somebody will come and palpate and say, oh, you've got pain there, that's what you've got. We can't really do that with a horse. So the information we get from their owner and carer is really important. The physical exam that we do, listening to their heart rate, listening to the gut sounds, is also really, really important. And then to be able to find out what's going on, then we have to do a rectal examination, to put your hand up the horse's bottom and to have a feel and see what's going on. And that's really the only way we can get a good idea of what's going on in there. And then there are other tests that we can do. So we will pass a stomach tube sometimes. So horses can't vomit. And if they get any blockage, the fluid builds up and up and up in their stomach. And if that's not released by us passing a tube, it can end up rupturing, which is inevitably fatal. So passing a stomach tube isn't a very nice thing. The owners don't like it. The horses don't like it. We can have some nosebleeds, but really, really important test for us to know whether fluid is passing out of the stomach, and really important for the horse. And then some of those things will give us clues, but we can only, even if you put your hand up a horse's bottom, you can only feel probably about a third of the abdomen, because the horses are so big. So we use other tests to try and get some more information about what's going on. So ultrasound is really useful. I'm about 5'5". You give me a really big horse and I can't feel very far, but you give me an ultrasound machine and I've suddenly got a window to look much, much further and get a lot more information. So ultrasound is really useful. And we also have a range of blood tests, and often the ultrasound and the blood tests are also really helpful in giving some information about both what type of disease, what's going on, but also what the best treatment might be in terms of whether it's surgery or medical. And also they can give us some clues as to some information about the likelihood of that horse surviving as well. So lactate measurement, for example, really, really helpful in terms of what proportion of horses are with this level of lactate are likely to survive surgery. That kind of information, super helpful from the blood tests.
Absolutely. So this is a question that I'm curious about personally. We hear different viewpoints on walking the horse when we suspect colic versus allowing them to lay down. When would you say it's appropriate to walk the horse versus allowing them to lie down?
Yeah, so I'm really glad you asked this question, because there's a group of us that got together a while ago to discuss this, because we see sometimes horses that are walked and walked and walked when they have a really bad lesion in there, when they have some dead gut. And the easiest way I can explain this is, imagine if you have an appendicitis or a ruptured appendix and somebody walked you around for 2 hours or told you to go and jog because it would be good for you. It would just be the worst thing to happen. But if you'd eaten a bit of spicy food and a bit of had trapped gas, then actually walking might be quite helpful. And it's very similar for the horses. So a small amount of walking is okay. as long as it is a mild colic. But if it is something really severe and catastrophic, all you're going to do is exhaust that horse. You know, they shouldn't be walking. So what we agreed as a group of us that talked about it is that a maximum of 30 minutes of walking exercise only, without, you know, without the vet's input. The vet may come along and say, it isn't this, it is this, we need to do some more exercise. But until you know that, don't do more than 30 minutes. Don't do anything more than walking. Because again, imagine trotting something when they've got dead gut in there, just really, really not fair on that horse. And also if the horse really, really doesn't want to do it, then don't force them. So if you're able to do it and the horse is able to manage that, then do that. But no forced exercise, no prolonged exercise, no heavy exercise until you've spoken to your vet and they've made an assessment and decided whether that would be helpful or not. And people kind of struggle with that because they then think, what can I do if I'm not allowed to walk my horse? But there are other things you can do to give them a safe environment. So it's fine for them to lie down. It's fine for them to roll. Rolling doesn't cause twists. They're usually rolling because they've got twists. So what you can do instead is take anything out of the stable that might hurt them, give them some extra bedding, take them into a pen that's got a sand or something that they can lie down. So whatever position makes them comfortable, allow them to do that and create a safe environment for that.
Yeah, I'm really glad we discussed this because I always remember growing up when we had a horse colicking, people saying, never let it lie down, no matter what. And I've since heard that the same thing you just said, as long as they're in a safe area, they're okay to do that. So I think it's important to maybe spread that message around.
Yeah, it definitely, you know, it affects the horse's welfare. And like I say, imagine if you've got a piece of dead gut and somebody's forcing you to walk around, you know, that's not what we should be doing. But there are times when it is helpful as well. So it's just getting that balance and picking up the phone and asking your vet as well can be really helpful.
Absolutely. Yeah. If you could correct one common misconception that barn managers have about colic, what would it be and what should they be doing differently?
So one of the misconceptions that we found was around survival rates after colic surgery. And lots of people think that older horses won't survive. And lots of people think that horses can't go back to competing after colic surgery. And both of those things aren't true. Older horses can do very well after colic surgery, and horses can go back to competing at very high levels. There's a number of studies across Europe and the US that have looked at horses going back to show jumping, racing, high level competitions. And there's lots of reasons why somebody may decide not to have colic surgery in their horse and to have them euthanized instead. And all of those reasons are good reasons, whether it's because they can't manage the box rest, they can't manage the finances, it's not right for that particular horse. The thing that I am very passionate about is that they don't make a decision to euthanize based on the wrong information. So I think as yard owners, just making people aware that actually there can be a good outcome, but there is a risk that the horse won't survive, but the risk isn't higher for older horses, and that horse can go back to living a full competitive life after surgery. I'm not saying they all do, but they can do that. And it worries me that sometimes people get the wrong information and they make a decision when that horse and you know might have survived and might have made it through.
Yeah, and I often hear people say that you should have a conversation with your barn manager and your veterinarian before something happens, an emergency situation, so that you can be prepared with the correct information and everyone involved in the horse's care kind of knows where you're coming from, and you don't have to have these difficult decisions while you're also worried about your horse.
Yeah, so I work with the British Horse Society in the UK, and we have some resources that are free for anybody to use and to access, and it includes an emergency plan. And the emergency plan is, what would I want to have done with my horse? If I'm not there, who can be contacted? Where's my vet? Have I got my transport ready? Have I made a decision? And we talk right at the beginning about those horses that have the severe lesions and deteriorate very, very quickly. You do not want to be waiting to find out, you know, and thinking about what's going on. You need to go, right, my horse needs emergency care. I've thought about it. I've made a decision. I've got my transport. I've got my finances. I know where I'm going. I know how far along the lines I'm going to go with treatment. all of those things makes a huge difference in terms of the horse's outcome, but also the horse's welfare. You know, we don't want them hanging around while we're trying to decide what we do. Somebody that's thought about that beforehand, shared that with other people on their yard, makes a huge difference.
Absolutely. And we will link that plan in the show notes so that people can easily access it, because I think that would be very helpful for our listeners.
Yeah.
So we're coming to the end of our time, but my final question for you, especially as a researcher, is, are there any new breakthroughs on the horizon for colic?
Yeah. So I'm involved in some work looking at computer vision, which is a type of artificial intelligence that looks at images and analyzes them. And we've got this running in a couple of competition yards, a couple of hospitals, and a really big yard in the UK of over 90 horses. And what we're able to do now is monitor horses 24/7 and get information about how they're eating, how they're sleeping, what they're doing all throughout the time. So that is really useful in terms of flagging horses that have changes in their eating patterns or are eating their food very quickly and might be at risk of gastric ulcers. And what's particularly exciting for me with my background in colic research is that we've also trained it to recognize signs of colic and generate alerts. So it's nearly at the final stages. We've got it running. But for me, it's a game changer in terms of being able to have 24-hour monitoring of your horse and then an alert that says your horse is showing signs of colic. And it's one of the things I've wanted to do throughout my career. And I'm really excited that we're getting close to being able to, well, we are seeing it at the moment. We're just continuing to trial it and check it, the colic detection. But I just think it's going to be a huge breakthrough for yard owners.
That's amazing. I'm excited to see more about it as you guys continue to develop that. So that's all the time we have for today, but it's been amazing talking with you. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you very much.
And thank you all for listening today. Please remember to like this podcast, subscribe, leave a review, and recommend the Stable Management Podcast to a friend.